welcome to this edition of the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast. I'm Suzanne Gilt, and today I'm joined by Rachel Fitzgerald from our property litigation team.
Hi, Suzanne.
So thanks so much for joining me today. We're going to discuss tenant repair liabilities which diverge from standard to keep the property in good repair and condition, and specifically the impact that has on the commercial tenant's liability. So what are those variations you wanted to discuss?
Thank you, Suzanne. Yes, there's three variations I wanted to touch on. The first one, where the parties agree to the tenant carrying out certain works within a set time frame following the commencement of the new lease term. Then a second one, of where there's an agreement to limit the tenant's repair liability to a certain standard. And lastly, where the repair is to be to the satisfaction of the landlord surveyor.
Okay, so the first of those variations, which requires a tenant to carry out certain works at the start of the lease, is relatively common, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite common. And it can be very clear-cut if there's just a general obligation on the tenant to complete certain works by a specified date. In that scenario, if the tenant carries out the works by the deadline, there'll be no breach of the lease. But if the wording of the covenant provides, for example, that the tenant will commence, diligently proceed with, and complete the works by a prescribed date, a tenant who focuses only on the deadline for completion of the works but has not commenced the works within a reasonable time or thereafter diligently proceeded with them may actually find itself in breach. So agreeing to such a covenant therefore does bring with it a risk for the tenant, as their breach gives rise to the landlord's ability to forfeit. Importantly, the usual statutory protections which tenants have against a landlord forfeiting during the term of certain leases doesn't apply to these fixed-term repair covenants.
Ooh, is that an easy way for landlords to forfeit the lease if the tenant's in breach?
Well, not necessarily. And a landlord shouldn't consider such covenants as a smooth route to possession, as firstly, the right to forfeit can be waived, and secondly, the tenant will need to be given a reasonable period to remedy the breach. In addition, much will turn once again on exactly what the parties negotiated, and in turn is expressed in the lease. So, for example, if the parties were to negotiate an obligation on the tenant to put the premises into repair forthwith, an eager landlord who's attempted to forfeit because the works were not carried out immediately would fail, as forthwith will likely be construed as requiring performance within a reasonable time, unless there were some exceptional circumstances requiring immediate performance.
Okay, so the first of these three covenants is one for actually both landlords and tenants to be wary of in the context of the possibility of forfeiture.
Yes, exactly. Now, the second variation I wanted to touch on is where the parties agree to limit the tenant's repair liability to a certain standard. Anecdotally, Suzanne, you were telling me earlier this week that such a form of covenant is very common at the moment due to the number of short 2 to 3 year in-between lettings for office space in the city due to the dearth of cache-grillé space. So I think it's opportune for us to give it a bit of attention.
Yep.
So a common formulation is the tenant's conventional repairing covenant, followed by a proviso that the tenant is not obliged to keep the premises in any better condition than their condition at the date of the lease. Usually, but not always, the covenant will identify the condition at the date of the lease by reference to a schedule of condition, which may include a photographic schedule. For me, in property litigation, a disproportionate number of dilapidations disputes have some element of a schedule of condition issue. These issues can be that maybe there was meant to be a schedule of condition, but the parties didn't get around to doing one. There was a schedule, but in the passage of time, it has been lost. Or the written descriptions in the schedule are overly vague and unhelpful, things like saying it's a reasonable condition for its age. Or the schedule of condition is just photographs. And of course, photographs can only tell you so much. So, for example, with a piece of plant, the photo will confirm that it aesthetically looks great or poor, but it doesn't tell you if it's actually working for its purpose and therefore defective. All of these scenarios that come across my desk leave a very unsatisfactory outcome and will most likely force the parties into trying to find out the state of the premises at the relevant date with reference to extrinsic evidence. Compiling that evidence, if possible, will be time-consuming and costly and governed to some extent by the amount of time that has elapsed since the relevant date. The compiling of that evidence and the risk of needing to have the evidence tested at court and potentially determined by the expert evidence of a surveyor is a scenario not anticipated by the parties when they would have negotiated such a form of covenant.
So what's the position then if that covenant just doesn't make any reference at all to a schedule of condition? Does that help?
Well, regrettably no. The position will likely be the same and the parties will still find themselves scrambling around to find extrinsic evidence from the relevant date. Now, what I have seen in practice is that in this scenario where there's no schedule of condition and it has never been anticipated in the form of covenant that there will be a schedule of condition, one party rather cleverly has the foresight to go away, prepare the schedule and keep it to themselves. That schedule, generally presented by the tenant at the point of terminal dilapidations in response to the landlord's schedule of condition, can be something of a slam dunk, as the landlord often will have no evidence to the contrary of the same standard. Two separate issues can arise when there are a schedule. Firstly, the schedule only records part of the premises, and the repair covenant only limits the tenant's liability to that part of the premises recorded in the schedule. The lease provides that the tenant shall not be required to keep the premises in any better condition, insofar as the same is evidenced in the schedule. In that scenario, a tenant may unwittingly find himself with a significant repair liability for those elements not recorded in the schedule. And secondly, even if there is a very comprehensive schedule of condition, the parties may have agreed that it only applies to the repair liability or the yield-up covenant and vice versa. In that scenario, often to the party's great dissatisfaction, it's a question of lease construction, whether the other covenants are to be read as subject to the same qualification, or where they take effect as unqualified obligations. All very unsatisfactory. Now, I don't know what you think, Suzanne, but from my perspective, a schedule of condition covenant may be seen as a win for a tenant. But in practice, the financial outcome may not be all that different to an unqualified covenant. This is because if there has been a breach of the qualified repair covenant, it may be impossible or simply uneconomic to produce the exact state of the premises as shown in the schedule of condition. And the only practical way of restoring the subject matter to the required state will be to carry out works which result in the premises being repaired to a higher standard. So, if I can give you an example, the schedule of condition might show that a small part of the front door of the premises was rotten at the date of the lease. By the end of the lease, the rot may have spread significantly, so the whole door needs replacing. In theory, the tenant could perform his obligation by installing a door which is in exactly the same state as was the original door at the date of the lease. In practice, however, this is likely to be either impossible or uneconomic or both, and the only realistic way of performing the obligation will be to put back in a brand new door. If so, that is what the tenant must do, and it's just the landlord's good luck. It is thought, however, that the tenant could not be criticised if he were somehow able to find a second-hand door which was in about the same condition as was the existing, a little bit rotten door when demised.
Well, that's absolutely not the outcome I would have expected at all.
Absolutely not. And then, you know, interestingly, there's a similarly unsatisfactory scenario that could arise where the subject matter of the obligation has been altered or removed during the lease and the tenant is obliged to reinstate it at the end of the term, for example, under licence for alterations. In such a case, there may be no practical alternative to putting in a new item. Suppose, for example, that the tenant removes a suspended ceiling, which was recorded in the schedule of condition as being in a poor state of repair, and the tenant is then obliged to reinstate it at lease expiry. In theory, he could put back a ceiling in the same state as the original, but the more practical and cost-effective course is likely to be install a new one. For me, this is a tenant beware form of covenant, and yet one which many tenants see as a positive outcome in negotiations. Now, the third and final repair liability I wanted to touch on is where the parties agree that the tenant will keep the premises in repair to the satisfaction of the landlord surveyor.
That's not actually a covenant that I come across very often. Is that your experience too?
Yes, certainly it is my experience that these are not a very common form of covenant. And I think that might be because they do give rise to a whole host of issues in practice. The main issue is what happens if the surveyor fails to engage or the landlord fails to appoint a surveyor. This issue is all the more pronounced come the end of the lease term. A tenant at that point may wish to carry out the requisite works and yield up not in breach. One question in these sorts of situations will be whether the tenant's liability is dependent upon the landlord appointing a surveyor to perform the prescribed functions under the covenant so that no liability arises until such time as the surveyor is appointed. where the identification of the works is dependent on the landlord surveyor being appointed to specify them, this may be an indication that such appointment is intended to be a condition precedent to the tenant's liability.
Well, for what feels like a very landlord-friendly covenant, that is an unexpected consequence.
Absolutely, and certainly one I think many landlords would be shocked to realise. Now, the position is likely to be different where the works which the tenant covenants to carry out are sufficiently described in the lease to be capable of objective identification, and the surveyor's role is simply to oversee and approve the work. In that scenario, the tenant would be in breach if he simply refused to carry out the works because there was no appointed or engaged landlord surveyor.
What I also see in practice is issues arise regarding reinstatement liabilities. Do that sort of issues cross your litigation desk?
Absolutely, they do. Now, in this context, I think it's helpful to give an overview of the two categories of reinstatement liability. Firstly, we have the form where the tenant shall be liable to reinstate all alterations unless notified to the contrary by the landlord, or the other form, secondly, that the tenant shall have no liability to reinstate unless notified to the contrary by the landlord.
The warning with reinstatement liabilities really is timing and record keeping, isn't it?
Absolutely. When agreeing the reinstatement liability at the outset of the lease, a tenant will want to make sure that the drafting requires the landlord to tell it well in advance, say 9 months before lease expiry, what is required of it. Because while the actual works may only take, say, 4 weeks, additional time will be needed to be afforded by the tenant to prepare for carrying out the work, including, say, the tendering and its internal processes. A landlord, on the other hand, will want to keep its option open until as reasonably late in the day as possible, so that if an incoming tenant might like the fit out, that the landlord can in turn serve notice requiring the tenant not to reinstate, if that is what's required of it. Now, both parties will want to keep a clear record of what it is they agreed to regarding the reinstatement liability, so that the landlord's service of a notice to reinstate is served by the deadline prescribed in the lease, and for the tenant to actually carry out the works, and make sure that those deadlines are not missed. If a landlord is required to serve notice so as to trigger the tenant's reinstatement liability, and that deadline is missed, the tenant will have no liability to reinstate, and certainly, as we well know, this can have a significant impact on the value of the dilapidations claim.
Well, thanks very much, Rachel. Some really top tips there for both our landlord and our tenant clients. Appreciate your joining us today. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.